So I actually want to begin by telling you about my ordination. The theme of these talks is ordination will change your life. So a good place to start is ordination, isn't it? And I was ordained quite a long time ago when I was 19 on a weekend retreat after I'd been involved for about 2 years. And my ordination was and still remains in my mind a very magical event, hugely significant, hugely meaningful. Everything led up to that event, everything has led away from that event. I mean, no doubt that that was the pivotal moment in my life, and it's a constant reference point. Not in a nostalgic way, I don't look back with nostalgia at it. It's quite hard to kind of talk about the in some ways, about why, you know, in the way I think about it, but it's just sort of there. More than a memory, it seems to have a kind of timelessness about it, I suppose, because it just was so deeply meaningful. And since being ordained, I think in some ways I've been trying to plumb the depths of what it meant to go for refuge, to have my going for refuge witnessed, as we say now. We didn't talk so much in those terms in those days. To be a Dharmachari, it wasn't Dharmachari in those days, we had a different name, but to have my going for refuge witnessed by Bhante Urgyen Sangharakshita. And it was a completely magical weekend for me. I felt very open, felt full of reverence, devotion, faith. I was young. Bhante was, I think, in a particularly inspired mood. I was ordained that weekend with Ratnaguna, and he seemed on particularly inspirational form. He kind of got dressed up for the ordination, not just in his robes, but in a fantastic gold brocade Tibetan shirt, and his hair was long in those days. There's a painting that Aloka did that sits in our community lounge, and that's how he kind of looked in those days. It's a very special painting for some of us, that particular image of him. And not only did he perform those ordinations, both the private and public ordinations, he led study on a text of Milarepa called The Shepherd's Search for Mind, and at some point he started to talk even about the nature of mind. And when, you know, it was, I don't like these words, but there really is no other words to use, really. It was a very strong experience for me, a very powerful experience for me, being ordained. And I think particularly the connection that was made between myself and Bhante. I'm going to call him Bhante, not just Urgyen Sangharakshita Bhante. And the connection that, through my connection with him, that was made with the practice he gave me, Guru Rinpoche, Padmasambhava. It had a very, very strong effect. In fact, an effect that was really too much for me, I think. I think it was really overwhelming for me. And I think it took many, many years before I could sort of absorb the impact. I think, in a way, that's still going on. More recently, I was reflecting on well, why? What went on? And I came to the conclusion that one dimension, an incredibly important dimension for me, was that why it was so strong was because someone, Bhante, who I had immense respect for and indeed reverence for, and who I still have those feelings for, they are unchanged, he took me completely seriously. He took my spiritual aspiration completely seriously. In that ordination ceremony, it's as if he was saying, this is real. I don't mean real in the sense of, in the technical sense, but this is authentic, this is real. In fact, he said in my private ordination in relation to something, this is what you really are, but you haven't realised it yet. But he was taking my spiritual aspiration completely seriously. Someone who I loved took me completely seriously. This is not a game, it's not a fantasy, it's not escapism. This is the real thing. That's a very powerful thing when that happens. It's a very powerful thing when you're taken seriously by somebody you respect and have reverence for. And a week or so after the ordination weekend retreat, he sent me a postcard, and in this postcard he was particularly concerned to point out that I'd taken on to transcribe this seminar on the Shepherd's Search for Mind. And in the postcard he was particularly concerned to point out that I actually transcribed absolutely everything. Make sure that you transcribed every single word. Well, I took him at his word. I transcribed every single cough as well. He was very concerned about that in those days, Spanty. Very concerned that everything was taken down exactly. But there was another thing about this, and at the end of the postcard he just said, what a perfect weekend. So he'd obviously had a very good time as well. But what was also interesting about the postcard, it was a reproduction of a painting by Magritte, the surrealist painter. I think he's a surrealist. And it was, this painting was of a beautiful blue sky. And in the sky, three apples were floating. A golden apple, a red apple, and a blue apple floating in space. And the title of the painting was First Love. First Love. And I thought, well, that's interesting. In those days, when Banti sent people postcards, these were pondered. Their meaning was pondered. You know, what's the hidden teaching? And, well, it didn't take me too long to realise, hey, those apples are the colours of the three jewels. Those are gold, blue and red. And it's called First Love. As if he was saying, well, you know, your first love now is the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, the three jewels. Your first love are the three jewels. And I found that very interesting, and I've reflected on it a lot since that time. He knew, even then, that love was a big issue for me, a big concern for me. He knew that I had a strong tendency to fall in love, violently, and so on. He knew because I told him. And he probably knew that it would be an issue for the future, which indeed it has been and still is. Love is very important to me. And he knew in particular because some months before I was ordained, I went through a very turbulent and rocky period. It wasn't the first time I'd fallen in love. I mean, most of my fallings in love had been hopelessly unrequited. But this time it was my first scene. Sorry to use a... I think you know what I mean. My first scene. And it wasn't so successful, really. I got all over the place through it. It didn't help because the woman that I fell for and had a scene with was actually really in love with Surita. not me. Which hasn't affected our friendship in any way, actually. In fact, I had actually a dream which indicated this. Very interesting, before I even knew. Well, I knew, didn't I, on a deep level. Anyway, so that really stirred me up, and I was all over the place. My meditation, my practice was affected quite strongly. But eventually it calmed down. Got back into my practice, especially the prostration practice, the going for refuge and prostration practice, very, very important to me in those days. So this is before I'm ordained. And I wrote to Banti about it, and I mentioned something like in this letter, well, I'm glad to say that the attack of emotional turbulence and conflict has calmed down. And he wrote back with some very interesting information about the going for refuge and prostration practice. But at the end of his letter, he said, well, I'm glad that the attack of emotional turbulence and conflict has calmed down. The only protection against such attacks are regular practice of puja, regular practice of meditation, spiritual friendship, study of the Dharma, and selfless service. He might have mentioned ethics as well, but those five are the ones I particularly remember. Unfortunately, I've lost this letter, which is a great shame. I lost it on my travels somewhere. So regular practice of puja, regular practice of meditation, participation in spiritual friendship, Dharma study and selfless service. And he said, these things will not only protect you against such attacks, they will serve as the basis of transcendental insight, for the arising of transcendental insight, and then you will be protected by transcendental insight. Now, I'd forgotten this teaching until a few years ago. It kind of resurfaced. I was telling my life story, I think, out at on one of the Guhyaloka courses, and I remembered it just sort of came up from the depths, the depths of memory, this particular teaching, if you like, that he'd given me. And I've thought about it since I remembered it, on and off since that time. And recently I realised that I have, in fact, based my life on these practices. And if ordination has changed my life, it's because of these practices. And I can't say that I've sort of consciously gone around doing these practices in this set. It's just happened, and I think it's just happened because, of course, that teaching that Bhante gave me wasn't just something personal to me. It was something that he's given to all of us, even created an environment in which we can do these practices, as indeed other order members have done, because the order members who, well, many order members that were ordained before me had worked to provide a way of doing these practices. They're very basic, if you like, practices in our order and movement. But I also realised recently that these practices are the way I express my first love, my love of the three jewels. That's why I've engaged with these practices. They're an expression, they've been an expression of my feelings towards, well, for life, for the Dharma. And I'm deliberately using this word expression. A few years ago, an old friend of mine, very old friend of mine, told me that he didn't think meditation had brought about any change in him. And he'd been meditating for many years. He was going through quite a difficult time. And I suddenly found myself saying, I said, well, I've never meditated to change. And I thought, well, that's a weird thing to say. I mean, that sounds almost theoretical. I've never meditated to change. I've actually meditated to express something. I've always meditated to express something. It was a very important realization for me. Of course, there's much to change. And I hope there has been at least a little change. But there's loads of stuff to change. When I look at myself, there's lots of petty, gross, you know, greed and craving. You know, you should have seen me knocking back some Indian sweets I was given last night. I get irritated, I get angry, I have aversion, I'm downright stupid, at times deliberately confused, so that I don't have to, you know, really make up my mind about something and behave in the way that I should behave. I'm lazy. You know, if I was left to myself, I'd just lie in my bed all day reading thrillers. And there's no point pretending that this isn't the case. I'm not giving myself a hard time here. I'm not doing a bad self-meta thing here. You know, this is actually the truth. In fact, I get quite inspired when, you know, you get those, when I think of how stupid I am. I quite enjoy it when I'm in a particular kind of mood. I don't mean in a sort of masochistic way, but I don't know if you've ever come across some of those Tibetan teachers. Is one of my favourites is about this particular Lama, this kind of entreaty, saying, oh, Buddhas, have compassion for us Dharma charlatans that fill the land. And then he kind of gives an inventory of his faults. Well, I find that really inspiring. I quite like that. I think that's great to know exactly where you stand. So, yes, there's much to work on, much to change. And I think it's also important to say that. Because I do know people do get a bit daunted when they come on these weekends and, you know, they read the Dharma and all that sort of thing. And they can easily think, it's very easy to think that older members, Dharmacharis, are really sorted out, kind of perfect beings. But, not the case. Not so. We're all working on stuff. There's much to change. But that isn't my prime motive to go for refuge, to practice, to live the Dharma, to meditate, to perform puja, to be with friends, to live in a men's community. to work for the Dharma. I do these things because I love doing these things. I love doing these things because they give expression to what is deepest within me. That's why I do them. And that means that sometimes I do them, I can do them, when, in a way, there's no reason to do them, when it's difficult, when it's painful, when I don't sort of like doing them. The sort of love I'm talking about is deeper than love, in a way, deeper than likes and dislikes. This is why I get up in the morning and meditate, because I love doing these things. I want to give expression to something. It's why I love the similes that Bhante used to invoke quite a lot in his early lectures. The lotus simile. Padma does mean lotus flower, doesn't it? And his emphasis on spiritual life as a flourishing, an unfolding of what is deepest within us. This is actually the real meaning of development. Sometimes people use this word development or the developmental model in a way that I don't really understand. What I understand about it is that you're bringing what is deepest forth. You're bringing it forth, and that is what effects change and transformation. For example, when I do the Metta Bhavana, what I see myself doing as bringing forth, as unfolding, as bringing into a flourishing and abundance, loving kindness from, you know, the potential of friendliness that I already possess, I already have. Some years ago, in my reading, I came across something I found very evocative indeed. A quote from a late Neoplatonist philosopher named Proclus. And Proclus talks, has a wonderful image of the prayer of the sunflower and the prayer of the lotus. And he describes the unfolding of the sunflower and of the lotus. And he said, if you could hear the movement of the unfolding on the air, you would hear a prayer. You would hear the prayer of that being. By prayer, he doesn't mean a petition, a petitionary prayer, not asking for something to be given, but prayer in the sense of a longing to fulfill what is deepest in that being, or even prayer in the sense of a praising of their celestial archetype, their endless fulfillment. Proclus even says, every being prays, in the sense that all beings, what they really want to do is bring forth, is express, is embody what is deepest within them. So those practices, if you like, are my prayer, my praising, my expression of longing, the way I love. So let me just say a little bit about each of them, just very, very briefly. First of all, there's puja. I've put it first. I can't remember the order in which Bhante put it in his letter to me. But I put it first because actually it was my first practice. The first time I went along to an FWBO class in Brighton many years ago, what happened at that class, and I'm very glad it was this class, was a full length, full dress Metta Bhavana practice, 5 stages, with quite minimal but very clear instruction. So a full scale Metta Bhavana. And then there was the sevenfold puja with mantras. And the meditation was very difficult, I have to say. It was very uncomfortable as I tried to contort myself into the full lotus like the yogis I'd read about with great difficulty. But when I came to the puja, it seemed so familiar. This was my language, this was my territory, and particularly the mantras, the chanting of the mantras, this seemed to be very, very familiar. This wasn't a new thing, this was something I knew, and I don't think that's to do with past lives or something like that. I think those mantras, those sounds were really giving expression. I was recognizing something deep within me, deep within life, that I felt such a resonance with. An endless kind of possibility seemed to be opening up through chanting these things. So puja is very important practice for me. And by puja as well, I take this to mean that it's not just the regular practice of puja, but this is the whole world of faith, devotion, imagination, symbol. It's the whole world that we've come to call the mythic context. It's very important to have that going on in your life. It's very important to have it going on in my life. It's my lifeblood in some way, to make contact with that dimension of things. And without that, I definitely can't function at all. And then secondly, there's meditation. Meditation, of course, there's loads to say about meditation. Meditation is a very, very rich field, indeed, very rich field in the FWBO and the WBO. There's a lot of practice and there's a lot of discussion of practice and how to approach things, all sorts of new things, coming in. For me, actually, the most important meditation for me is my sadhana, is the regular meditation on, in this case, Guru Rinpoche. That's extraordinarily important for me, and of course it's gone through all sorts of phases and stages and unfoldings since taking it up all those years ago. So in that sense there's a kind of overlap between puja and meditation. But very important as well for me in meditation is simply the bringing forth of awareness and loving kindness. Recently, I've been doing more mindfulness of breathing and metta bhavana, just doing more of those practices and discovering just how rich they are, how important they are. And of course, they do bring about change and transformation. But I see it primarily, those practices, as the bringing forth of awareness and loving kindness. Those two great wings, great wings of the spiritual life. And you can take those all the way if you go deeper and deeper and deeper into them. And then there's spiritual friendship. So this brings up the whole world of sangha and spiritual community. That's always been extraordinarily important to me. When I look back and when I look around now, I'm very, very conscious that my own spiritual life has been possible because of the kindness of others, the kindness of other people, the kindness of my teacher, Urgyen Sangharakshita, the kindness of my spiritual friends. Basantra is one of my Kalyana Mitras, and when I was first around, Basantra gave me that all-important quality, that all-important, that best quality of a Kalyana Mitra, incredible encouragement. He took me seriously. He didn't just think I was some, youngster on some kind of crazy trip. He took my aspirations seriously and received nothing but encouragement from Basantra. And there have been many other friends like that who've given me so much. And even now, so many friends that make spiritual life possible. When I think of Padmaloka, I love Padmaloka. I love being at Padmaloka. We're going through a very good phase at the moment. Community is particularly good at the moment. But we're all very conscious that Padmaloka is only possible because of all the people that have contributed it to it, down the ages, since we got it in 1976. We stand on the shoulders of all these spiritual friends. And of course the other aspect of spiritual friendship is indeed expression. It's great to be able to express love directly, cleanly, and to have it received. It's so important that loving isn't just about being loved, it's as much as about being able to express it straightforwardly, warmly, cleanly, without misunderstanding. And I find that the world that I'm in, I can do that very, very freely, very, very easily. It's a wonderful gift. And of course, spiritual friendship, sangha, is something unfolding in our own order because we're inspired by the Bodhisattva ideal. We want to, make contact with more and more people. So, I'm very fortunate at Padmaloka because so many people come in who you know, I've never met before, and we have the opportunity to make contact with them. And then there's Dharma study. What a wonderful thing that is, reading the Dharma. I remember when I first started to read Dharma books, it really was a first love. You know, I just used to eat Dharma books in when I was first around, and there weren't so many around in those days. It was just wonderful, just tremendously exciting and vivid. The scriptures, the great teachers, Bhante, just loving reading them. Again, I guess because there's that sense of recognition. I remember the first Dharma book I read was Foundations of Tibetan Mysticism by Lama Govinda, and I have to say, I didn't really understand a word of it, but I was utterly thrilled. I was utterly thrilled because what was being described by Lama Govinda was a spiritual world, a vivid, rich spiritual world that you could actually enter. And there was no God, there was no creator, there was no end point. There was just this endless field of exploration which he evoked brilliantly. And of course then there's studying with others. There's that wonderful experience of just talking the Dharma, Dharma Katha as it's called traditionally, of talking the Dharma with others. It's one of my most pleasurable experiences, and it's actually a practice. Sometimes people think of, you know, well, meditation is practice and study is sort of what you do to meditate. But study itself can be a very powerful practice. A number of times I've gone to a study group, frankly not really feeling like being in it and leading it, but you've got to turn up, you know, people are there waiting for you. And within minutes, you know, in talking about the Dharma with people who are serious about the Dharma, you're off. You're into another state of consciousness. You know, something's kicked in, something very rich and vivid. It's happened so many times. So it's a wonderful practice, thrilling, and that when you're really thinking and feeling with that thinking as well, and discussing with people as well, with bringing that thought and feeling with others, well, then something very exciting starts to happen. New ground, new territory starts to open up. And of course, it becomes particularly exciting when you start to apply the Dharma to your life, when you, as it were, bring down the heights that the Dharma scales into your everyday experience, whatever it is. And you know, whatever state you're in, no matter how rubbishy it is, you know, how crappy it is, forgive the expression, you can always apply the Dharma to it. The Dharma's got something to say about it. There's something to reflect upon in that state. You know, the Dharma doesn't just sort of happen when you're on good form, you know, in a special place. You can bring it into every moment, every situation. And then there's selfless service. I must admit, in the original letter, you know, he went through those things, and I like the other things. But when it came to selfless service, I thought, well, he must mean work. And I was very puzzled by it. And I remember showing it to my good friend Loka Mitra, another Kalyana Mitra, who I was living with at the time. And he immediately said, selfless service, that's good. You know, because he was quite keen to get me to do more selfless service, I think. But no, he was very inspired by it. But I was a bit puzzled. But yes, he was really evoking work for the Dharma in the broadest sense. Doing whatever needed to be done to make the Dharma available to others, whatever needed to be done. And in my time as other Dharmacharis, and I think some of you have done, we've all done all sorts of things to make the Dharma available to others. We've heard about Karanar door knocking this morning, but there's all sorts of things that we can do to bring the Dharma to others. At the moment we've got a building project going on down there, transforming old Dorm C into you know, a really splendid new facility. Well, that's Dharma work. That's working for the Dharma. That's working to bring the Dharma to others. But this selfless service thing, I've been thinking about it a bit more. Actually, in some ways, you could say it's the overarching theme, in a way, of all these things that he's mentioned. In a way, it's probably the most important point. I beginning to see what he means by selfless service is actually participating in the activity of bodhicitta, the will to enlightenment for all beings, the essence of voidness and compassion, as it's sometimes called, the urge to bring wisdom and compassion, their quintessence, their quintessential non-difference into the world for the benefit of everybody. That with this selfless service, he's really evoking the importance of playing a part, playing, in letter to me, of course, playing my part in bringing this bodhicitta into this suffering and in many ways, for many people, meaningless and hollow world, bringing in that richness of bodhicitta, that extraordinary richness of love and awareness, playing my part in that and not being bothered about position or status, not even being bothered about personal attainment of, in a way, getting somewhere, but just playing my part with others, with the spiritual community, with others in the world, to bring love and awareness into the world. If you like to, I'm going to invoke an image that I'm particularly fond of, invoking the wise and glorious king. I came across a Nyingmar text some years ago where it talks about bodhicitta, if you like, in the highest and deepest sense, in the sense, and describes it as the wise and glorious king. The wise and glorious king. This king, of course, is not a tyrant or anything like that. It's the true king, the just king. Love and awareness evoked for the benefit of all. That's what I want to bring into the world. That's what I want to play my part in. So these five things then express my love of the three jewels. I think saying they've changed my life, I don't know. Perhaps other people have to be the judge of that. But that's the way I want to live. They're the way I want to live. They're the way I've been living. Actually, one of the things I'm interested in doing, which I'd like to think about doing next year, is actually, for those who are interested, is sort of basing an ordination training around those five things, those items. So if anybody's interested in that, in exploring that with me, how that might be, I'd be very interested to hear from you. But that's enough from me for today. There's plenty there to follow up and talk about and think about. So we'll go and have a tea break, and then we'll go to our groups and have some discussion.